a Supreme Court leak on abortion, Indiana's primary election results, plus school referendums largely successful, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 6th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana legislative leaders aren't saying just how far they'll go in banning abortions if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns its longstanding abortion rights precedents. A draft opinion from the court that leaked Monday night would allow states to enact full bans.
What little public polling there is on abortion in Indiana shows that a large majority of Hoosiers oppose an abortion ban that doesn't allow exceptions, like in cases of rape, incest, or when the life of the pregnant person is at risk. It's not clear how far Indiana Republican leaders will go if the Supreme Court fully overturns Roe v. Wade. In a statement, Senator Roderick Bray described the leaked opinion as good news, but said lawmakers will monitor further for a final decision. House Speaker Todd Houston said the vast majority of Republican lawmakers want to take further action to ban abortion based on the court's final decision. 100 Republicans out of 110 in the General Assembly signed a letter in March asking the governor to call a special session to align Indiana laws with the Supreme Court's eventual ruling. The Indiana Democratic Party said State House Republicans' push to ban abortions will cost lives.
How far will Indiana go in banning abortion? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Chris Mitchum. Caitlin Lang, State House reporter for the Indianapolis Star. And Nikki Kelly, Editor-in-Chief of State's Newsroom, Indiana. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith, and if you were paying attention, yes, that is a different job title for Nikki Kelly, who left the Journal-Gazette this week after a couple of decades there. We're very happy to see her in her new role where she'll still be leading State House coverage for a new outlet. Chris Mitchum, back to the topic at hand, though. How far will Indiana Republicans go?
Well, I think it's first important to emphasize that this whole conversation is surrounding a leak, right? So we don't know if this is the final draft. We don't know if other Supreme Court justices are going to want to edit the opinion that we saw, and we don't know if this even has the 5 Supreme Court majority to make this the real thing. So I think it's an entirely separate conversation of what that can do to the integrity of the judicial branch. All that being said, when it comes to Indiana, I think they find themselves in a very unique situation, just because I think trigger laws around the country have come to the forefront. People are starting to realize those. People are starting to realize the old statutes that could go back, could be enforced if Roe is overturned. Indiana has neither of those. So that puts them in a very unique situation to, I think, adhere to what the Supreme Court opinion says, which is the Constitution does not open any legal right or any constitutional right for an abortion. So we're going to kick this back to the states and allow the citizens to converse amongst each other and elect people that best represent their views.
Beyond abortion, there's questions about the legal logic that Justice Alito uses in this ruling and whether it could be used to strike down interracial marriage, gay marriage, gay rights in general, school segregation, and any number of other things. So how far does this movement from conservatives go?
Oh, I think it goes way too far. And I know you dodged that question very aptly, but you dodged the question. The fact of the matter is, if the Supreme Court kicks this back to the states, Indiana's going to do whatever it can do. And that means it may even criminalize it. If they were doing it sensibly, what they ought to do is have hearings all around the state and actually listen to what people think about this. But they're not going to do that. They're going to come in and one day in one of their closed caucuses, they're going to present a piece of legislation. They're not going to allow any second reading amendments, and they're going to go ahead and enact it. And it's going to be as poorly thought out as Texas is. You know, you get into these situations. Are we going to prosecute doctors? Are we going to have 2 different countries where you can have an abortion if you live on one side of the Wabash River, but you can't have it if you live on the other side of the Wabash River? And if you go across, can you be prosecuted then in Indiana for doing something that was legal in Illinois? And if the doctor performs it there or sends you there, could he then be prosecuted? Could he have to avoid the state of Indiana on the way back to the East Coast? It's crazy. It is absolutely crazy. And the fact that the ideology of the Republican Party, because this is owned by the Republican Party, and that Supreme Court represents the Republican Party, and it is frightening. And it is frightening to so many young women who are going to face very difficult choices. You know, I've never met somebody who's pro-abortion, never in my life. But there are situations that call for it. I mean, if you have a pregnancy that's doomed to death and doomed to suffering for the mother or the child, it's the idea that that legislature, composed primarily on the Republican side of old white men, can dictate to women what they are allowed or not allowed to do is frightening.
Well, I'll respond to that. I think it's hard to group them all as old white men. You've seen every single major abortion-related piece in the legislature has been championed by women.
How recently, many women do you recently. Have in your How many women do you have in your caucus out of that 70? What, 10%? Maybe. Don't tell me that you're representing women, because you're not. You're representing a certain type of woman that you recruit, so you can hold her up there and say, "See, we're not anti-woman."
They have recently been authored by women, I will say.
Nikki, I want to. Yeah. She brought up the question of, will Indiana ban abortions or not? Seems fairly simple. Yes. There's a lot of other things, though,
yeah,
that could
I mean,
be part of that.
There's a question if they're going to just ban it outright or if they'll do like an 8-week, you know, anything under 8 weeks. I think the bigger question will be around any exceptions they have. You know, do you have an exception for rape or incest? Most of the Republicans I'm talking to are saying no. But there still seem to be a bit more support for the exception for the life of the mother. So I think a lot of the debate will be around that topic.
Do we criminalize it?
Well, I mean, you'd have to. Otherwise,
for
doctors and women?
Yeah, but that's the other question.
Right.
For whom is it criminalized?
Right.
Is it just who's performing it? Is it the person
what
who
do
seeks
you do
the
with
abortion?
But there has to be some sort of penalty. Otherwise, what's a ban?
What do you do with the pills? What do you do with the pills that can be mailed? What do you do with interstate commerce? I guess we throw that out, too.
Well, we'll see what the ruling
says, so.
I guess. And raise the idea of hearings around the state or the legislative process here. Would you expect this to go pretty quickly once it's made possible?
I do. I think it would probably be pretty similar to what they did with redistricting, just that this would be a special session most likely, so they're not going to be hanging around following the usual calendars. I mean, I'm sure they will take some public input, yes, but I'm sure they will want to avoid much of the second reading amendments as much as they can, because that is going to get really messy. I think a lot of these people have ran on being pro-life, but now we're getting down to, what does that actually mean? How anti-abortion are you? When it comes to the exceptions and in terms of the timing limits on these things. So I don't think we have a clear picture of what this legislation will look like, but I know that it's probably going to be pretty messy because you still have lawmakers who are going to completely disagree on what this should look like.
I want to, before I move off this topic, I want to ask about the governor here, because this week he was asked for a statement after the leak, and then he was a group of reporters spoke to him the following day, and the answer to will you call a special session and what do you support was, I'm going to wait and see. You know, it's too early to say anything. I'm going to wait and see. Even to the, if this becomes reality, would you then call for a special session? I'm not going to discuss that right now. Politically speaking, what sense does that make from a Republican governor?
Well, I think he's kind of going off of his previous stances on these kind of controversial topics. When you even look at the gun legislation that was before, he was very hesitant of taking a position until it came push come to shove. He ended up doing it, and I think you can see similarities in that situation to this one. But I think he's also just kind of playing the cards that you're also seeing Speaker Houston play and Senator Bray play, which is, at the end of the day, this is still a leak. We're not going to pin ourselves down to any decision in case this changes at the end of the day.
He raises an interesting point, which is that Houston and Bray have said roughly the same thing in terms of what the legislation they'll push is, but they've already called on the governor to call a special session even before months before
right.
this leak.
Right.
Do you get what Governor Holcomb is doing?
This is typical of Governor Holcomb. When has he shown leadership at all in the, 5.5 years he's been in office? He just doesn't. He's just there. He's occupying the chair. If he wanted to show leadership, what he would say is, you want a special session? Okay, we'll give you a special session after you commit to holding hearings around the state and having a frank, open discussion about the pros and cons of various alternatives to this. I'm not going to let you go back in your secret room with your cigars as a majority that doesn't even need to worry about a quorum and make a decision affecting the lives of millions of people without any public discussion. But he won't do that because he just doesn't have... The wherewithal.
Are you a little surprised that...
Yeah, I mean, he clearly missed an opportunity. I mean, look at every Republican governor in the country and stuff they're calling for. He could still say, you know, this is just a leak and we still have to see what the actual decision was. But then there's that second sentence that you can add to the statement, which says, but I look forward to protecting life and I want to work with legislators on that. But
which
he didn't even go there. Right, but he didn't
saying.
Even go there.
Far from, you know, not wanting to get out over his skis, I guess, is there an argument to be made that by being somewhat silent on this now, he's hurting himself politically with his own party?
I think so. I mean, I think the political decisions he's been making have been very interesting, I guess. And I don't know if that's just because that's what he believes and he's not trying to make any political moves. That kind of beats me. I can, I guess the one thing I would say is that the lawmakers have shown that they don't always listen to what Governor Holcomb wants. So I think he does probably realize that if he does call a special session, he might not have much control over the final product that makes its way
well,
to
he wouldn't anyway, yeah.
But then he doesn't have to call the special session if he really doesn't
want
to.
He doesn't, does wait and then do it during normal session where there is more time to get something, you know, more worked out.
And after an election.
And I'm wondering if he's trying to delay the pushback that you are going to see from major stakeholders, not only in the Indianapolis area, from around the state. You've seen it with the hate crimes legislation, the CRT legislation,
the transgender sports
RFRA back bin. Yep. You know there's going to be pushback comes
well,
to this.
There's going to be a lot of pushback.
Correct.
So it is going to be a dichotomy in the approach of all the candidates between Republican and Democrat. And let's see if they want to stand behind something that the voters don't support, like what they're going to do with this criminalizing abortion.
We'll see. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, if the Supreme Court clears the way, will Indiana fully ban abortion with no exceptions for rape, incest, or the life of the pregnant person? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, how many statehouse incumbents will lose in Indiana's primary election? Fewer than five got 49% of the vote. It turned out to be six. So those 39% who said 5 to 10 were on the money. 12% said more than 10, and maybe they were the Liberty Defense folks. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, only a small handful of Indiana Statehouse incumbents lost their re-election bids in Tuesday's primary. Look at the synergy there. There was a concerted effort this cycle by more conservative challengers to unseat lawmakers, but few were successful.
There were always going to be at least three incumbent losses this year. That's because there were three races with incumbents facing off against each other. But one of those was part of a larger trend this cycle. Republican Representative Kurt Nisely lost to his House colleague Craig Snow. Nisely has long been one of the two most extreme members of the GOP at the State House. The other most extreme member also lost. Representative John Jacob was one of the incumbents upset by an outside challenger this year. Still, two candidates who channeled anger among some conservatives over perceived inaction at the State House, over COVID-19 mandates, and government overreach did unseat incumbents. That includes Republican Representative John Young and 10-term GOP Rep. Dan Leonard, considered one of the more moderate Republican voices at the State House.
Ann Delaney, was this largely a status quo result when you look across the field?
Pretty much, really. I mean, with the exceptions of the couple of targets that the Republican caucus had in Representatives Nisely and Jacobson, spending
an incredible amount of money. Two of the six incumbents who lost were targeted by the House Republican caucus.
So, I mean, and they spent a fortune on, I don't know what they spent on the Nisely race, but they certainly spent a fortune on the Jacobs race. And they got somebody who probably down there is not quite as outspokenly, I don't want to know, racist, anti-Catholic, anti-Muslim as Jacobs was, but probably will vote the same way. I mean, she's certainly not a moderate. She's for the rule of law, but not for Roe v. Wade, so it's only some laws that she's for the rule of. And, you know, I don't know, faith, family, and law and order. Wow. She put an apple pie in there. It's a
vote. Wins votes.
Yeah.
What does the loss of Dan Leonard mean to the caucus and the State House?
I think that, looking back, I think the GOP is going to see that as their biggest loss easily. Not only is he a staple in a lot of the complicated unemployment and tax issues that you see, he was in charge of the rules procedure. He was the one that, if there was any amendment that they thought were non-germane to a bill, he was the guy that kind of made the motion and a lot of the times gave really good reasoning as to why this rule was violated.
And that's part of the reason he was targeted by these conservative challengers who were able to paint him as the face of the, as in their minds, obstructionism.
There, yep.
So it's going to be a role that's hard to fill.
Yeah. To that point, Nikki, I want to ask you, obviously you know Representative Leonard really well. You covered him for a long time. But in terms of who becomes the next Rules Committee chair, it feels a little inside baseball. I'm not going to ask you for a prediction. But if you're someone in that caucus, do you want to be Rules Committee chair after the last guy was targeted for defeat and lost?
Yeah, it should be someone in a very safe district. Though, frankly,
pretty safe.
I mean, and he outspent her 10-1. And she still won. It was all grassroots up there. It was all sort of this, you know, grassroots group, the Liberty Defense. It does. When it happens, it's that.
It's just too bad they didn't recognize that he's helpful in the legislature. He's well liked. He's well respected.
But he's a moderate.
The institutional knowledge being lost there is significant.
Just
for the institution, if nothing else. Caitlin, when you look at I'm going to ask about Governor Holcomb again, because we talked to him about the results, and a lot of people were channeling anger towards Governor Holcomb when they were challenging Republican incumbents, even if a lot of these Republican incumbents were probably a little upset with Governor Holcomb too. But does this sort of bolster Holcomb's standing in the party, at least in the state, that a lot of results didn't go against him or the establishment?
I think maybe a little, but I mean, you got to look back. We just had a gubernatorial election, you know, sort of recently, and he still won that one easily too. And so I don't know that it would change the dynamic of things all that much because of it. But I think it does show that, you know, maybe the group of people that didn't think our lawmakers were conservative enough, maybe they are more in the minority than maybe we thought. Because again, only six lawmakers were ousted. Three of those, I believe, you know.
Yeah, three had to be ousted.
Right, because of redistricting. Yeah. So I don't think there wasn't this huge ouster that I think the Liberty Defense Group and some of those others were hoping for. So I think the establishment kind of won in this case, whether that's because of, you know, the money they put towards it. They, in the first pre-primary reporting period, they had spent $1.2 million. That's more
incredible
than they have this entire, you know, century here. So I just think you can't ignore how big of a factor that money played, too.
Yeah. Well, staying on election results, voters approved 7 school referendums this week. Only Vigo County Schools and Franklin Township failed to get approval. This was Franklin Township Community Schools' 4th proposed referendum since 2009, and all have failed. More than 60% of district voters voted no. Vigo County Schools also failed to get approval for a construction referendum with more than 65% of votes against it. The district won voter approval in 2019 for an operations referendum. Most of the referendums that passed got more than 60% approval, including Edinburgh, Griffith, MSD Perry Township, and both Lebanon Community Schools referendums. Both Mount Vernon Schools and Valparaiso Community Schools referendums received about 55% approval. Nikki Kelly, we've talked on the show before about whether all of the school spending that we've been seeing out of the legislature the last couple of years would force schools to be more hesitant about these referendums, particularly because we've also seen pushback at the State House about referendums, though some of the restrictions haven't been successful so far. But do these results give other schools thinking about asking for money a boost? 7 out of 9 is not bad.
Yeah, I think so. I particularly thought that some of the operations ones would have a little more trouble, because if you're looking at like the budget the legislature put out last time and you're saying, oh my God, they gave, you know, all this massive new money, and we obviously have a lot of money that is available for the next budget as well. So I'm surprised, given all the new money that has flowed, that on top of that they asked for operations money for, you know, teachers and classrooms and stuff. So that part surprised me a little more than the other ones.
I mentioned in my question to Nikki that, you know, the idea of the legislature, we've seen some bills authored these last couple of years about starting to restrict, you know, how referendums are done, when they can be offered. For instance, I think there was a bill to, you couldn't do them in the primary anymore because they tend to succeed in the primary as opposed to the general. Do these sorts of positive results mean more bills to restrict referendums in the future?
I think they could. It's hard to say if the results would have been different had it not been a primary, and this is a pretty big success rate. The only ones we saw fail were the capital referendums. So I just think that's really interesting and shows people's priorities. I think to Nikki's point earlier, you know, I think obviously, like, there is some surprise that districts would ask for the money given, you know, the influx of state money they might have received. But also, I don't think normal people are paying attention to that much. So I don't think normal people are putting that together, you know, to think, oh, they don't need any more money. So I think sometimes we forget that people don't always live and breathe everything that happens at the State House.
Yeah, I was going to say, God knows the people around
the
state
normal.
Are not normal.
But to
both the points they just made, she pointed out that the only two that failed were construction ones. Nikki was saying that she would have thought it would be construction that would be successful. How much can you read into this cycle's results?
I think you can read into it as it's truly a grassroots effort is needed. I know that the Vigo County superintendent came out and said, we just simply did not do a good enough job of reflecting the needs to our community. The democratic process works, and we simply didn't do a good enough job, versus I think it was the Valparaiso superintendent came out and said, a lot of our efforts was focused towards making sure people even understood the referendum question, first of all, and then making it clear this is where our money's going to go to benefit the whole community, rather maybe than just certain segments.
Yeah, to that point, I mean, you know, you look at Franklin Township's failed 4 times since 2009. That doesn't feel like part of a trend. That feels like Franklin Township is just struggling to get that vote.
Well, no, Franklin Township property taxes are relatively high, and that's largely because they don't have commercial and industrial development down there. So they're paying a price for that, and so they're reacting to it. The idea that the legislature would restrict the ability of locals to do this is crazy. Because you have people coming out and voting to increase their own taxes. They can vote no, as we know that can happen. And, you know, yes, there was an influx of funds. There still isn't enough money in public education. And I think what you can read into the 7 out of 9 is that there is a lot of grassroots support for traditional public education. They want to see the buildings look good for the children, and they want to see the teachers paid adequately to attract the kind of talent they need. And that's a good thing.
Well, and more than any election, these type of things are very local issues.
Very, yes. Very.
Yes, particularly, you know, in a primary.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, the Bail Project filed a lawsuit this week against the state over legislation set to become law on July 1st that would curtail some of its activity.
The lawsuit targets House Enrolled Act 1300, which restricts nonprofits like the Bail Project that help low-income individuals pay their bail. The new law prohibits the organization from posting bail for anyone charged with a violent crime or anyone previously convicted of a violent crime that is charged with a felony. The suit, led by the ACLU of Indiana, alleges that the organization's activities are expressive advocacy and therefore protected under the First Amendment.
Caitlin Lang, what's the background behind this law in the first place?
This law was intended as a package of bills to target crime, specifically in Marion County. You know, this comes up pretty much every year. With this particular bill, it was targeting the Bail Project. There was some misinformation surrounding it, or misunderstanding, I guess I would say, about how much of the issues can be connected to the Bail Project versus other bail bondsmen, family, that sort of things. Basically, this stemmed from, you had a couple of people who were charged with homicides that were connected to the Bail Project. But when you look at the numbers, a lot more people are connected to traditional options, family, friends, commercial, that sort of thing.
Yeah, to that point, I mean, there was a couple of high-profile cases where the Bail Project had bailed people out who then went on to allegedly commit violent crimes. But to say that only the Bail Project was the problem and not traditional bail bondsmen with this sort of law, does that make sense legally? I'm not going to ask you for legal analysis.
Sure.
Does that make sense?
You don't want that.
Does that make sense to you?
Because they're doing the same thing, ultimately. Obviously, the revenues are coming from different places. But at the end of the day, and the author of this bill made it clear that there is no there's no regulation, there's no oversight on these charity bail organizations at all prior to this legislation being enacted. And even the legislation still says we're only targeting violent offenders, repeat offenders with violent histories. And so I think that's mainly the main crux of it going forward.
This is a totally phony bill, okay? It's phony because they're attempting to do something or saying that they're doing something about violent crime in Marion County. They don't want to deal with the issue of guns in Marion County and the fact that 14-year-olds can get it over Instagram connections. And all of that can be traced to the fact that in this state, I think they're going to issue guns when the children are born. It's ridiculous how easy they are to get. And that's all this is, to say we did something about violent crime in Marion County. It doesn't do anything, and it's going to be thrown out because it targets one group that isn't doing anything different than all the other groups and actually providing some competition to some of the bail agencies that are out there. So it's not going anywhere, and it is bogus. And what they ought to do is deal with concealed carry and the other things that are contributing to the violent crime here and around the country.
I'll be honest, I'm not a lawyer. I have no idea how this case is going to be resolved. But at the very least, Nikki, we didn't get an ACLU lawsuit on abortion this year, so at least we're getting an ACLU lawsuit on something
maybe
else,
maybe they need
right?
funding.
Yeah, I mean, they usually win to get those fees.
Fees,
so.
They get the fees. They'll get them on this one, too.
The state of Indiana has been a major contributor to the ACLU
Absolutely.
For the last several years, so I guess maybe they've got another chance at a payday. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Anne Delaney, Republican Chris Mitchum, Caitlin Lang of the Indy Star, and Nikki Kelly of States Newsroom, Indiana. Got to get used to saying that. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR. Or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.